Hi, my name is Patty Burke, and I am an alcoholic.
I like the bigger podiums where you can hide behind. And my sobriety is June 10, 2002. And my home group is the world's famous Monday Night Speakers Meeting in St. Petersburg. And I have a sponsor, and I have the opportunity to help others. And I'm a little bit nervous. I hate speaking. But I absolutely show up and do anything I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, because what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is give me a whole brand new life, not a patched up old life. And for that, I will be forever grateful. And I guess I'll just like start from the very, very beginning. I was born and raised in New Jersey, and I had this dad who drank all the time. He was drunk all the time, and I loved him. I thought he was so fabulous. He was nasty and sarcastic and funny, and I loved him. He was absolutely my hero, and I wanted to be just like him. And he never missed work, and he was just awesome, you know. And I had a mom, and she did not drink. I thought she should have drank. She probably would have been a lot happier if she had a few drinks every once in a while. But she didn't drink, and she stayed home, and she took care of the kids and my father in the house. And her life looked really boring to me, and I never wanted to be like my mom. And I never was like my mom, I can guarantee you that. And I have two older brothers, and I have a younger sister, and I don't remember them at all. I don't remember them ever living with me or with them at all. So it's self-centered from the very beginning. And I just remember, like, before I really started drinking, I was so afraid of everything. In first grade, I was so afraid that I literally couldn't even move. I was, like, frozen in fear, where the teacher literally had to carry me from, like, to the lunchroom to our class. I was just so afraid. And I couldn't put words to it back then, but I hated her because she carried me around. And I hated the kids because they made fun of me because the teacher was constantly carrying me, you know. And I just could not wait to grow up. The only real memories I have as a child was when I was being with my dad. My dad would drink all night long, and he'd get up and he'd start drinking coffee in the morning. And I remember getting up in the middle of the night just so I could hang out with my dad because he was so funny. And he'd be watching black and white movies, and he'd be drinking. And I'd get him a beer, and I'd pop it open, and I'd drink as much as I possibly could until I got into the living room. But I don't remember the effects produced by alcohol at that young age, but I know I did it every night. And my first time I drank, I was 14 years old, and we cut school and we went to Jersey City. And I tell you, without a doubt, that was my very first spiritual experience, because for the first time in my life, I could breathe easy, I could look you in the eye, I wasn't afraid, I could care less what you thought of me. And what happened that day is pretty much from the very beginning to the very end, this is how my drinking went. I started to drink. I immediately became very seductive. My clothes came off, and I went into a blackout. And that's how I drank from the very beginning to the very end, except towards the very end, I wasn't very seductive. But that's how it was. And I tell you, that first night I got drunk and I went into that blackout, I found something that worked so well that made me so free for the first time in my life, that I was never, ever going to wait for anybody ever to offer me alcohol, because I just found something that was so freeing, you know. And so I lived up the street from this liquor store, and I would take my lunch money every single day and get all mine to buy me alcohol. So I was a daily drinker from the very beginning. And I got in a lot of trouble. You know, I had a lot of consequences from the very beginning, because when you're drunk and naked at the age of 14, you get in a lot of trouble. So I had a lot of consequences, and I did not care. It was well worth it, just so I could be free, just so my head would stop, just so I could be comfortable in my own skin, you know. And at the age of 14, it was Memorial Day weekend, and I stood out in front of that liquor store, and I got old men to buy me alcohol, and I went to the beach, and I started to drink, and I ran into two guys who I had no idea who they were, but they asked me if I wanted to go drinking with them, and I was like, absolutely. And so I jumped in the car with these two guys who I had no idea who they were, and we went off to go drinking. And what happened that day absolutely changed my world. And what happened that day is I wound up getting brutally beaten and raped, which does not make me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. I'm not like normal people. Once I start drinking, I cannot stop. And when I stop, all I do is think about it. But that day absolutely changed my life, because back then it was 30 years ago, and we didn't know how to deal with rapes, especially in my area, and so I immediately became a victim, And my family didn't know what to do with me, and the school didn't know what to do with me, and they started sending me to counselors and stuff, and I was drinking all the time, and they thought, well, I guess if I was raped, I would need to drink too. Let's just leave her alone and let her drink the way she needs to drink, because eventually she'll stop. And so at a young age, I was allowed to drink the way I needed to drink, you know, and I really believe that I didn't have any suicide attempts throughout high school because I was allowed to drink the way I needed to drink. And all these psychiatrists and therapists, I mean, I've seen tons and tons and tons of them, like lots. And one of them started putting me on medication, and they said to me, now, Patty, if you drink on this medication, it's going to triple the effect of alcohol. And I was like, that is fabulous, you know what I mean? And so I took my meds, and I was blacked out even quicker, you know, and I barely made it through high school. But I did graduate high school, and I graduated with a note from one of my many psychiatrists. And he said that if I didn't graduate my class, that I'd have a breakdown. And they just wanted to get rid of me. So I did graduate high school, and I was very excited about that. And I was the very last person in my class to graduate. There was 470 people that graduated in my class, and I was the very last. And but I'm happy I graduated. And so I was 18 years old when I graduated high school, and my family's like, yeah, we've had it with you. You're 18 years old. You graduated high school, we've done our part, and it's time for you to go. And I was like, see you later. And I left home, and I moved in with a go-go dancer. And she had this son, and I was supposed to watch her son while she danced that night. And my life started becoming very unmanageable. I started getting a lot of trouble with the law. I started getting DUIs, and my life was crazy. And I figured I really needed to do something, you know. Because I really felt like I didn't have a reason and purpose for living, but I did not want to quit drinking. I just wanted to control my drinking, because drinking was the only thing that was holding me together. But I needed to do something, and I never wanted to get married, and I never wanted to go to college. Well, I couldn't go to college. I mean, I had no credits when I graduated. I don't think they accept you with a note from your psychiatrist. So I felt like I needed to do something. And the only thing that I ever really wanted to be when I was little was to be a mom. So what I figured what I really need to do is to have a baby. Because if I have a baby, then I'll have a reason and purpose for living, and I'll have someone to love, and someone will always love me. So that's what I did. I set out to get pregnant, and I found a really dumb guy at a party, and I got pregnant. And my mother was a little upset that I was pregnant, and she thought it was best if I got married because I was raised Catholic. And she really wanted me to get married, and I didn't want to get married, but I figured I would do it because I wasn't going to stay married. And so one of my many psychiatrists just happened to be a reverend. So my psychiatrist married me. And this is how my dad describes me. Well, he used to. He would say that if I was in a stadium filled with brain surgeons, that I would pick up the hot dog vendor. And that's exactly what this guy was. He was like a hot dog vendor. And so I married this hot dog vendor, and he got a job one day, which was a miracle. I don't even think he's had a job since that day. And he went off to work, and I left. I took my little girl, and I left, and I started moving around. I moved to California, and I toured through California really quick, and I came back to Jersey, and I had this little girl that I absolutely loved with all my heart and soul, and I wanted to be the best mom. And she had the best clothes. I sent her to the best daycares. I mean, she had the best of everything, but she never had a mom. Because every opportunity I would get, I would drop her off with whoever would watch her so I can go out and drink that night. And then towards the end of the year, I would get a really big income tax check because now I have a kid. And then I would vacation. I'd leave her behind with her father. And I would vacation every year, you know. And I don't really remember a lot, you know. I went to a lot of places, but I don't remember saying a lot of stuff because I was always blacked out and probably naked. But the one year when I was vacationing in Southern California, I do remember because it was very traumatic for me because I wound up running into this really hot guy, and he was a Marine, and he was stationed in Southern California, and he was from one of the states that snows all the time, and he was really athletic, and I'm not athletic whatsoever. At all, but I really just wanted to impress him. Like, I want to impress everybody because I didn't, you know, back then I didn't even know who I was or what I liked. I liked whatever you liked, and I would tell you whatever you wanted to hear just because I wanted to be part of and I wanted you to like me. And so that's what I did. This guy was really athletic, and he was into winter sports, and he was into, like, ice hockey and skiing and stuff like that. And so what I told him is I told him I was an expert skier. Because he lived in California and I lived in Jersey, and there's no way I could get caught lying, right? So, and I just wanted him to like me. And so that's what I told him. I told him I was an the next fifth skier, and I got back to Jersey, and he was so impressed by me that when I got back there, he called me up and he said, Patty, I'm going to come to Jersey, and I'm going to take you skiing in Vermont. And I thought, oh, my God, that is so fabulous. I never drank in Vermont, you know, because my plan was I was going to get him good and loaded, and I just thought we'd just have a drunken weekend, but he really wanted to skate. And so since he thinks I'm an expert skier, we're going up the expert hill. And I'm telling you, it's very, 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 very high. And I'm, like, shaking. He's asking me, he's like, are you all right? I'm like, I just haven't skied in a while, you know. And so, and I've never skied even to this day, ever. And so we get all the way up to the top of the mountain. And I don't know how to get off a ski lift. I barely got on a ski lift, you know what I mean? So I fall off the ski lift and I get all tangled up in the hole, all the poles, and they have to, like, shut down the whole ski lift to untangle me, you know? And so I told him, I said, you know what, I haven't skied in a while, so I want you to go ahead and ski. I'll just meet you down at the end of the mountain. So he took off skiing, and it took me 4 hours to get down that mountain. I crawled, I climbed. I mean, it was a mess. I was absolutely drained. And he would, and since he really knows how to ski, he would ski past me a lot, you know. And if I wasn't already, like, on the ground, I would throw myself on the ground. I'd give him a little pose because I like to be seductive at all given times, you know. I'd give him a little pose, and I'd be, like, just resting. But I learned a very important lesson that day that I would never, ever lie about being athletic ever again. Because I got myself in... I used to get myself in all kinds of trouble just lying to people, just so I could feel part of, just so you would like me, telling you whatever I think you want me to say, you know. And every time my life would get unmanageable, I would get pregnant again. And I wound up getting pregnant 2 more times, and I tell you, by the time I was pregnant with my third daughter, I could not stop drinking. And I stopped drinking the first 2 times with my first 2 daughters, but this time I did not want to drink. And I couldn't stop. And I didn't want to hurt that baby. And every day I would pray. And I had a priest, because I'm Catholic. I was Catholic. And I had a priest bless the baby inside me. And I had holy water blessed by the Pope that I put on my stomach every day. And I'd have prayer services going on all over the country, and I could do all those things. And I could not stop drinking. And the day the baby came, I was terrified to deliver her because I didn't know what I did to her. And my best friend came in the delivery room with me. And when the doctor went to hand me her, I wouldn't take her because I was afraid what I did. And I handed her to my best friend. And when I seen my best friend smile, I knew that she was okay. You know, and I tell you, I knew from the very first time I picked up a drink at the age of 14 that I didn't drink like normal people. I immediately started hiding it, and I immediately did not want to stop. And I knew from the very beginning that I was powerless over alcohol, and my life was unmanageable since the age of 14. But I tell you, I didn't concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic for many years after that, you know. And I wound up marrying their father, and he was a chef, and we got to move all over the place. And he would send out his resume. They come in, they pack us up, and they ship us, we'd move wherever. And wherever we got to, I never wanted to be married, and I never acted like a married woman. And I would horrify my husband, and he'd pack up and he'd leave, and he'd take the kids, and I'd stay behind in whatever state we were in until I started missing the kids, and then I followed behind. And my relationship with my ex-husband was very violent. It was very abusive. He was mentally and physically abusive, and by no means do I think I'm a victim. I know I participated and showed up in everything in my world, and I knew if I pushed this man hard enough that he would hit me, or he'd lock me in a room and scream at me for 3 hours what a piece of crap I was. And then he'd feel really bad, and he'd leave me alone for at least a week so I could drink the way I wanted to for at least a week, and I was willing to take a beating to drink the way I needed to drink. You know, and by the end of my drink, and we lived in Georgia, and we had this restaurant, and I tell you, I am a complete disaster. And I am drinking around the clock. I have coffee cups filled with vodka hidden all over the house behind picture frames and everywhere I can, just so if he comes home and catches me drinking and he takes away my bottle, I'll have coffee cups filled up with vodka all over the house. And once again, we open up this restaurant, and I'm having an affair again with a really young guy, and he's had it with my crap. you know. And he comes home from work, and he drags me into the bedroom, and he gets on top of me, and he strangles me till I pass out. And I come to him, and he looks at me, and he says to me, he said, "Patty, if you were ever afraid of me, tonight's the night to be afraid of me, because I'm going to kill you." And I could see there was something different about him in his eyes, and he meant that he was going to kill me that night. And he started strangling me again till I almost passed out, and he just fell off of me. And I got away, and I called the police, and the police came, and they arrested him, and they put him in jail, and he was in jail, and he had really high bail, and I had this restaurant to run, and I'm a mess. I'm absolutely a disaster. And the police called one day, and they said that he was bailed out of jail, and then he was going to come back to the house, and he was going to, and he had to pack up his stuff, because now I have a restraining order on him. And I was already drinking, well, I drank every day, but I already had about 6 bottles of wine that day. Not that I'm a big wine drinker, but our restaurant only had a beer and wine license. And so I had about 6 bottles of wine that day, and after I got that call, I started thinking what my problem really was Georgia. I think if I get back to Jersey, I'm going to be okay. So I had a bright idea that I was going to pack up my kids, and I was going to pack up my car, and I was going to head back to Jersey. So on my way home, I stopped and picked up a 100-proof bottle of vodka, and I was going to unwind and pack up, and I was going to head out of there. And what happened is I came to, and my house was filled with police and the neighbors. And not only was my husband packing up his stuff, but he was packing up my little girl's stuff. And the cops told me that my little girls were better off with him than a drunk as a mother. And they were absolutely right, because I tell you, every single day I would endanger my little girl's life. I'd put him in my car, and I'd drive in total blackouts. And I'd run over railroad tracks, and I'd blow out the tires of my car, and they were absolutely terrified. And I did it every single day. And then one day, it was 8 o'clock in the morning, we pulled into the restaurant, and there was a tree in the restaurant, a parking lot, and I hit the tree. And my youngest was 4 years old at the time. And she went running into the restaurant, and she said to her father, she said, "Daddy, I'm so afraid. Mommy's acting weird again." And she fell asleep, and she hit a tree, and I'm so afraid. And I got into that restaurant, and he started yelling and screaming at me. And I looked at my 4-year-old, and I said to her, "See what you did?" Because I really believed that everybody else was the problem. And I knew he had nowhere to go with these little girls, so I left. And I tore through St. Petersburg really quickly. So if I met any of you in a blackout 8 years ago, I apologize. And I had nowhere to go. So I decided to go back to Georgia. And by the time I got back to Georgia, I weighed 80 pounds. And I was yellow, and I was bruised from head to toe, and I had long hair, and it was falling out, and I had bald patches all over my head. And I couldn't go 20 minutes without a drink, because if I did, I'd shake so violently. And I felt like I was hyperventilating, and my head would attack me so bad that I wouldn't know what else to do but to take another drink. And since I can't go 20 minutes without a drink, I can't even work in the public anymore. And I wound up moving in this crack hotel. And I tell you, the things that I had to do each and every single day to get me a bottle of vodka was an absolute nightmare, because that's not how I was raised. And I couldn't believe where I wound up. And every day was so hard. And I just wanted to die, you know. And I didn't know that, I didn't know women that drank like me. And I didn't know women that were doing the things that I was doing. But I thought I heard that people who do drugs do these things. And since I'm living in a crack hotel, I thought what I should start doing some of this crack, and I feel a little bit better about myself, you know. So that's what I tried to do. I tried to smoke crack, and I was better at skating than smoking crack. I couldn't coordinate it. There's pushers involved and all kinds of stuff. I was way too drunk to smoke crack. And the crackheads absolutely hated me, because what they do is when they smoke crack, they get really paranoid and they hide. And they don't want to be found, especially by me. And so I would find them, and so they hated me. And they would just take away the pipe and give me back the bottle. And they, so you know, it was pretty bad when crackheads hate and they're not even smoking crack with their crack, you know. And my life was such a mess, you know, and I just wanted to die. And across the street from my crack hotel was this car dealership, and the mayor owned it, and he cut the ribbon. I had this big thing at the grand opening of a restaurant. I had the mayor there cutting the ribbon. I had the priest blessing the place, you know, I'm in a blackout. And so I went over and I talked to the mayor, and he gave me a job detailing cars, so I didn't have to be out in the public, you know, and I could be spraying the hose and seeing rainbows drunk out of my mind, you know. And I moved out of that crack hotel, and I moved into a little trailer park. And I came into work one day, and the mayor says to me, where are the keys to that van, because we're selling that van today. And I don't know why I had the keys, but I had the keys back at my house. So he told me to grab something off the lot and go back home and get the keys. So I grabbed this big red truck, and I go back home, and I figure while I'm there, might as well have a few drinks, you know what I mean? And I start realizing, oh, my God, I've had about six drinks, and my drinks are just like this, just pure vodka. And so I was like, oh, my God, I got to get back to work. So I start rushing to get back to work, and I come to, and the truck is absolutely totaled. And there's police and fire engine ambulances around, and they put me in the ambulance, and they took me off to the hospital where they put 150 stitches in my face, and then they took me off to jail. And I tell you, when I got to jail, I was just so relieved. I was just so relieved to be locked away, because I really believed that the only way I would stay sober is if I was locked away. And I never wanted to go back to where I was. And eventually my dad bailed me out of jail, and now I'm back at this little trailer park, and now I'm doing the same things I was doing in that hotel. And I'm telling you, I am absolutely dying. And every day is just getting harder. And I'm getting, and I'm so lonely. And I'm so tired. And every day is just so hard. I can't even believe where I wound up. And my world just got so small and so dark and so dirty. And I just couldn't do another day of it. Because what happened is the alcohol stopped working, and I couldn't get into a blackout, and my head wouldn't stop. And no matter how much I drank, my head just would attack me. And I knew that morning I would just what I had to do that day to get another bottle of vodka. I just couldn't do it. And I tell you, I prayed all the time. When I was raped at the age of 14, I asked my mother. I said, "Mom, why would God let this happen to me?" And my mother said, "She passed on what was passed on to her." And she said, "Patty, God isn't punishing you. He's just making you stronger, because that's what you believed." So all these years, every time I put myself in the position to be harmed, I believed I was getting stronger to get to God. And I would always pray to St. Jude, because St. Jude is the patron saint of hopeless and despair cases. Because I figured God was so far out there that I needed to pray through the saints to get to God. And this day, when I just couldn't do another day, what I had to do to get a bottle of vodka, instead of saying a prayer to St. Jude, I said a prayer to God. And I said, "God, I can't do this anymore. I can't get any stronger. I need help." And I know there's a God, because God's the only one I asked for help that day. And I took a bottle of Tylenol PM, and I drank a half a gallon of vodka, and I came to in intensive care. The nurses said, "You're probably not going to make it." My family flew in, and my father thought he was going to have to take me home in a body bag. And eventually all the tests came back where I had no damage whatsoever. And from there, they no kidney, no liver, nothing. And from there, they shipped me off to a mental hospital. And not like a little psych ward. It was a whole hospital. It was fabulous. It's my favorite part of getting sober. I love the psych hospital. It was so fabulous. People were crazy, and I was crazy, and I was locked away, and they took us out in a cage, and we smoked cigarettes out there. I loved it. I felt so safe. I wanted to be there forever. And but they kept me there long enough till I stopped shaking enough to get me on a plane, and they got me back to Jersey. And I tell you, and I got back to Jersey, and I only had 7 days in this rehab, because that's all my husband's insurance would handle. And I tell you, all the blood was completely off my body. You could see every bone in my body. I mean, I was so thin, and I was still yellow, and I was such a mess. And when I got off the plane, my family's looking at me like, "Oh, my God, she's dying." And I'm thinking to myself, they are so jealous, and I look like a model. Look how thin I am, you know? And I get into this rehab, and they want me to do workbooks and worksheets, and I can't even hold a pencil, because even though I went through detox, I was still so shaky, and I couldn't read, and I couldn't write, and I couldn't do my worksheets and my workbooks. And they took me up into the office, and they were going to get me funding. And they went through my workbooks and my worksheets, and nothing was filled out. And they said I wasn't serious about recovery, and that I needed to go. And I just started to cry, because I had nowhere to go. And I never wanted to go back to where I was, because I felt like I didn't even have a soul. I felt like I was less than human, you know, living in that trailer park, doing the things that I was doing. And I never wanted to go back there ever again. I never wanted to feel that way. And I was willing to do whatever they wanted to do with me. And what they decided they were going to do with me is they were going to send me to York, Pennsylvania, to a recovery house. And York, Pennsylvania is a recovery town. They have like 180 recovery houses, and I don't know anything about anything. I'm just going to go, and I'm terrified, you know.
And I get to this house in New York, Pennsylvania, and I'm scared to death. And I walk in this house, and there's this girl who lives there, and she's on the phone, and she's talking to someone, and she, like, stops dead in her tracks, and she takes one look at me, and she gets back on the phone, and she's like, oh, my God, this one is a real doozy, and I think she has wet brain. And I was like, oh, my God, I got wet brain. I don't even know what it is, but I know I have it, you know, and I'm a mess. I'm an absolute disaster. I'm going to meetings. I don't understand what is going on around me. Like everybody was talking in a different language, and I felt like I'd gone too far, and I'd come back home, and I'd ask her, I'm like, are you sure you have wet brain? She's like, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure you have wet brain. And I'm like, well, don't tell nobody. And she's like, oh, I won't. She's like, and not only do you have wet brain, but everybody in AA is talking about you. And they knew they were all looking at me. She said, they're all calling you Skeletor. So now I'm a mess. You know, I have wet brain, and everybody's calling me Skeletor, and I'm showing them to these meetings because they have nowhere to go. And I am a complete disaster. And I wound up getting a sponsor, right? And the sponsor did the best she could. She passed on what was passed on to her. But I would call her and I would tell her things like, the guy at the 15 item or less aisle questioned me on my items. I feel like I'm going to kill him, you know, and she just didn't get it. You know, she's like, there's something wrong with you, you know. And then I wound up doing a fourth and fifth step with her, and it was not out of the big book. And what she told me when she did this was that I harmed nobody. The only person that I've harmed was myself, and the reason I was the way I was is because I didn't bond with my mother. And I don't know anything about AA, but somehow I knew that that wasn't quite right. And I was getting angrier and angrier, and I was getting worse. And I didn't think AA was working. You know, and I was just about to leave, you know, and every time I'd call her up, you know, she was just like, I don't understand. I stopped drinking and I got better. Well, I stopped drinking and I didn't get better. And so what she did, she said to me, she said, you know what, Patty, I don't think we're related. You need to go find a new sponsor. And what happened is she wasn't a real alcoholic. She was a problem drinker. She stopped drinking. She got better. You know, she passed on the best she could. She passed on whatever was passed on to her, but she wasn't a real alcoholic because I stopped drinking, and I got worse. And I didn't understand what was going on. You know, it was getting worse and worse, and I started thinking there's something wrong with me. Like, maybe I really am crazy, you know. And she said, Patty, you really need to go find a new sponsor. In the meantime, I was going to all these different meetings, you know, and I wound up running into this woman that she absolutely glowed. And she talked about how she felt like the scum of the earth her whole life, and she didn't feel that way today. And she certainly didn't look that way. And so when this woman fired me, and I also thought maybe she was firing me because she found out I had wet brain, you know. And so so when I seen this woman at another meeting, you know, and I would hear people, I just didn't understand what was going on. The only thing, I started relating to some of the things that were going on in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started hearing people talk about the hole in the soul. And that's how I felt my whole life, too, like I had a hole in my soul. And I would hear people talk about how they could walk into a room full of people and how lost and alone they felt. And that's how I felt my whole life, too. And I didn't know that other people felt that way. And so when this woman fired me, I wound up running into that woman that absolutely glowed. And I went up and I asked her if she'd be my sponsor. And she asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths. And I said, absolutely. I went to any lengths to drink. And so I got this new sponsor who was really not nice to me at all. She didn't care about one thing about my feelings at all. She hurt them all the time. But what she did care is she cared about my life. You know, and what she told me, she said, Patty, people have been telling you your whole life, if you just stop drinking, you'd be okay. And she said, and you stop drinking, and you are definitely not okay. She said, drinking has always been a solution for you, and now that your solution isn't working, you needed a new solution. She said, what I have is a spiritual malady, and what I needed was a spiritual solution. And she said, what I need to do is to go through these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because my new solution will be the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a spiritual awakening. And she said, everything I think and need and want, I'm going to put on this back burner, and I'm going to learn how to live this way of life with her. And that's exactly what I did. And what this woman did is she laid down her life for me. And she took me through the 12 steps, and I tell you, she never shut up. She talked all the time. You know, she talked before meetings, she talked after meetings, you know. She just never shut up. She also told me, too, she said everything in this world was temporary. The only thing that's everlasting was God. And she said that I must have a strong foundation with God. She said that I must have a love affair with God. And so she started taking me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know what was going on. I just knew that I was going to be willing to do whatever she told me to do. And I didn't want to question her, and I wanted to do everything she told me to do because I was so afraid that she would find out about the wet brain that I had, you know. And I finally got a job. Nobody would hire me. People don't want to hire you when you're yellow and have bald patches and you weigh 80 pounds, you know.
But I finally got a job, and I was working at this Denny's, right? And she said that I was going to get up every morning, I was going to do this third step prayer, and that I was going to try to help as many people as I could that day, and if I couldn't help them, I wasn't to hurt them. And I was to come home that night, and I was going to thank God for keeping me sober that day. And so that's what I started to do. I'd get up every morning, I'd say that third step prayer, I'd go out the door, I'd go to work, I was so helpful, they were giving me awards. I'd come back to that recovery house, and I was the oldest woman in the house, so I was like the mother of the house. And then I go to meetings, and I try to talk to new people, or just talk to anybody. I was just trying to be helpful. And every night I get home to that recovery house, and I throw myself on the kitchen floor, and I cry because I wanted to drink so bad. I was, like, holding on so tight because I never wanted to go back to where I was. But if something didn't happen soon, I knew I was going to have to take a drink. And I couldn't sleep at night. And when I did fall asleep, all I do would have drunk dream after drunk dream. And finally, I went to my sponsor, and I said, I don't understand. I don't think God's hearing me anymore. I said, I still want to drink. I want to drink every minute, and I miss my kids, and I don't understand why I can't see my kids, why I can't even just hug them for 5 minutes if I'm doing everything you're telling me to do. Why isn't this working for me? Why can't I see my kids? And she told me, she said, Patty, you don't have to physically hug your kids. God can hug them for you. And she said, and I want you to go home, and I want you to pray about that. And so I went home that night, and I prayed about it, and I had a dream. But I walked into a room, and all three of my children were there, and I could feel them hug me. And then somehow 2 days later, my middle daughter somehow got my phone number, and she called me, and I told her about my dream. And she said, oh, my God, Mom, I had the same dream. And so if God could bring me and my children together in our dreams, God could do anything. And I stopped having those strong dreams, and the obsession was lifted, and I did a fourth and fifth step with this woman. And I knew that I was the cause of all my problems. I knew I was selfish and self-centered. I knew all that stuff, but what I thought is I thought I was the worst person in the world. I thought I was the dirtiest, slimiest woman in the world for the things that I did. And what she told me when I did that fourth and fifth step with her, she told me that the things that I did when I was out there doesn't make me who I am. They're just things that I did. And she said that I needed to do everything I did when I was out there and drink everything I drank when I was out there. So when I got to the rings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I never had to go back out. And all those dirty, disgusting things that I thought I did when I was out there were going to be my biggest gifts to help other women. And she's absolutely right, because I get the opportunity to help a lot of people today, you know, and I don't regret my past, you know. And she told me that I was one of God's kids, and that God loves me, and that I should never settle for less, you know. And at this point, the state of Georgia is looking for me, and I'm probably going to have to do some time in jail, because it's my fifth DUI. And she said, we really need to get you moving on your amends, Patty. And I have a lot of states to go through, because I live in a lot of states. So she said, we're going to start with the closest state. And so she sent me to Jersey to start doing some of my amends. And she sent me with this couple who were in Alcoholics Anonymous who didn't know me. They just knew that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I needed help. And this couple laid down their life for me, and they helped me do my nine-step amends in New Jersey. And they said that the first amends I was going to make was with my father. And now, I tell you, I love my father. And every week we talk on the phone. And my father was, like, so sad. My mother died when I was 25 from colon cancer. And ever since then, he was just, like, so sad. And it was almost like I was the mess of the family, you know. And a week before I got to Josie, he said to me, he said, you know what, Patty, I really feel like for the first time in your life, you're going to be okay. And he said, and I got to tell you, I'm really tired. I feel like I live a life of a houseplant. And so when I got to Jersey, the first amends I was supposed to make was with my dad, and I couldn't find him. And finally I got in touch with my brothers and my sister, and they said that he had a stroke that morning. He was in critical condition. He was paralyzed, and he couldn't even talk. And my sponsor said, you still have to go make that amends. You're going to ask everybody to leave the room. You're going to tell your father you were wrong. You're not going to say you're sorry. She said, you've been sorry your whole life. And so that's what I did. And my father started to cry. And I said to him, I said, Dad, you know, there's a good chance I'll never be that person ever again if I continue doing the things that I'm doing. And my father did manage to say the words, I love you, and he died about a week later. So my dad got to see me sober before he died. And I got to make lots of amends that week, and I got to make amends to both those ex-husbands. And my second ex-husband said to me, he said, Patty, I really was going to kill you that day. The only reason I didn't kill you that day is because a bright white light came and hit me in the head and knocked me off of you. And like I told you guys earlier, I thought God was so far out there, and the whole time I've always been in the palm of God's hands. You know, and I still have a lot more amends to make. I made a bunch of amends, you know, and I've been through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have had a spiritual awakening. And I tell you,
When I was a year sober, I went to my sponsor, and I asked her about wet frame, and I found out I didn't even have it. And it was like such a weight that it was lifted off my shoulders, you know, and I found something that worked so much better than anything that I've ever tried in my whole entire life. And I wanted to save the world. And I was absolutely out of my mind, and I was out trying to save the world. I mean, I'm literally, like, picking up homeless people. I have people shipping people from other states to me, homeless people. You know, I'm, like, taking people through the steps, like, out of my mind. I'm working at a homeless shelter for my 50 UI and a women's homeless shelter. I have all these women on their knees in the parking lot doing the third step prayer because everybody's going to get sober. I'm, like, trying to take people through the steps at work who are already an alcoholic. I'm, like, yes, you're going to do this, you know. I'm absolutely out of my freaking mind. And I get this apartment, right, and it used to be an old store, so it has high ceilings, and I get this lumber. And I was going to build a loft, and I was going to start stacking these drunks because people were going to get sober because I said so, you know. And I start moving all these people in, and my life is absolutely insane. It was so much fun. I mean, people were stealing from me. They stole my checkbooks. I went through like 5 DVD players, you know. I mean, it was just like insanity. And nobody is staying sober. And I am not happy about this, you know. And I'm like, I'm not going to do this no more. These people are not listening to me, and I'm not helping nobody anymore. And so I go to my grand sponsor. I said, these people are not listening to me, and I'm not doing this no more. He's like, Connie, they're not supposed to listen to you. He's like, you're just the paper girl. You're supposed to deliver the message. What happens is between them and God. You just need to deliver the paper. And I'm thinking, he's just so old. He doesn't know what he's talking about. You know what I mean? He doesn't know what he's talking about. He said, I can't do this because two of the girls I was sponsoring went out together and really threw me over the edge, you know. And I was crying. He said, well, why don't you pray and why don't you ask God to show you in an obvious way what you're supposed to do? And so that morning I walked out of my apartment and I turned the key and I turned around and a paper boy abandoned his paper bag on my porch. So I thought that was a pretty obvious sign that I was supposed to carry this message, you know. And one of the girls that was living with me, she was 19 years old, and she was the same age as my oldest daughter at the time, and she couldn't stay sober. And I came home from work. I came home from work one day and I couldn't find her, and she was missing for 2 hours. And finally, some drug dealer calls me up and said that he had her, and that he was going to bring her home to me. And so he brings her home to me, and she's gray, and she's foaming at the mouth. And I've never seen anything like it, and I was scared to death. And I had to call the ambulance, and the ambulance came, and they shot her up in the heart, and they took her off. And then she came back home, and she wouldn't stay sober. And all these people I was dragging around, forcing them to go through the 12 steps and forcing them to think they want to get sober. What I found out is what I was doing was I was denying people their pain. You know, and nobody denied me my pain because if they did, I wouldn't be here. And I knew I was hurting her more than I was helping her. So she came home drunk one more night and I said to her, I said, you got to go. And the hardest thing I did since I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was to have to throw this 19-year-old out of my house. And I dropped her off at a hotel. And my heart was just breaking because I knew what she was going to do that night. I knew that she was probably going to have to prostitute herself out for a bottle of vodka. And it was the hardest thing I ever had to do, you know. And then eventually I wound up getting a 4-bedroom row house in the middle of the ghetto, which was so awesome, right? And the day I was down there painting my house, I was painting it pink and purple because it was going to be a house for girls. And she called me up. And she said, Patty, will you please help me? And she came over, and she wanted to get sober. And me and her together, we painted that house. We painted it pink and purple, and she moved in with me. And they started moving women in. I wasn't picking people up off the streets, you know. There's tons of women there who don't have sober houses to go to, and they can't live on their own, and the recovery house is just, like, crazy, you know. So I started moving women back into my house, and this way they had to be self-supporting and they had to be sober. And my thing was I just wanted to be a mom, you know. And here I am living in Pennsylvania, and my daughters would come every summer, but I just didn't have them in my life every day, you know. And I know God answers prayers because God sent me these three young women to come live with me. Because I couldn't have my own 3 daughters live with me, you know. And it was so awesome. And before I left, she had 14 months sobriety, you know, and she came down here and she spent some time. But But I stopped doing the things I was doing. I stopped dragging homeless people in off the streets, making them think they want to get sober. You know, because what I found is I was wound up denying people their pain, and I wound up hurting more people than I wound up helping. When I was about 2 years sober, I wound up switching sponsors. There was this man that I've been watching, because my first sponsor told me, she said, Patty, don't listen to what people say. Watch what they do, because a lot of people can get up to the podium and talk a good talk, but then they don't walk the walk. She said, so watch what people do. And I tell you, I watched this man, and I watched him help tons of people. And I watched him get really sick. And I watched him get so sick that he almost died. And in the midst of this, in the midst of him getting sick and almost dying, he never once missed a beat with helping anybody. And he had something about him that I didn't have. And I'm 2 years sober, and I didn't have what he had. So I called him up, and I asked him if he would help me. And once again, the member of Alcoholics Anonymous came and laid down their life for me. And what this man did is he took me back to the 12 steps. And he said, Patty, you don't tell people what to do. You show them what you do. And he said, you don't talk from your head. You talk from your heart. And so that's what I started to do. And once again, my life changed, you know. My life absolutely changed. My life was absolutely on fire. And my little girls would come every summer. And we'd have so much fun. My house was filled with drunks, and my little girls were there. And they would see people come in all beat up, and they watched them go through the 12 steps, and they watched these women change, you know. And one year when they were, one summer, it was like two summers ago, I guess, two or three summers ago, they were there for the summer, and they were younger then, so they would do a lot of babysitting in the rooms of New York, Pennsylvania, AA. And their father was here in Florida getting sober. And they watched all these girls change. They watched these girls go through the steps, and they watched their lives just come together. And their father was here in Florida, and I guess he was going to about one meeting a week, and he had a sponsor that didn't believe in God or something. I don't know, whatever it was. But when they got back to Florida, they said to their father, Dad, can we go to a meeting with you? Because Mom takes us to meetings all the time. And he said, yeah, I guess. So he wound up taking them to a meeting. And they said to him, Dad, that's not what they do in North Pennsylvania. They're doing it wrong. And they wanted to know what step he was on. And he wound up switching sponsors. Because my little girls see the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. They see one alcoholic working with another, how powerful it is, and watch people's lives change, you know. I don't know when I speak to. But I do want to tell you one story about one of my favorite women that I sponsored. And I didn't really sponsor her because I didn't get a chance. Well, I did sponsor her, but I didn't get a chance to take her through the 12 steps. But there was this one woman that showed up in New York, Pennsylvania. And she was really old. And she's about this big. And she's beat up from alcohol. And she has no teeth. And she shows up, and she's so lost. And nobody wants anything to do with her. And she's living in this recovery house with all these young women. And every day she shows up to a meeting, and she still has the same clothes on. And I go up, and I reach out to her, and I start talking to her, and I start picking her up every day, and I start taking her with me every single day with me. And we wound up going to Target one day. And she says to me, she said, do we have time that I can get some clothes? Because all I have is the clothes on my back. And she said, and I don't want to shower because I don't have clean clothes to change into. And all the girls in the house are really making fun of me, and they're being really mean to me. And I didn't know why she had the same clothes on. I didn't know that she didn't have anything, you know. And so she went and she got herself a little new wardrobe, you know. And she shows up with me every single day. And I have her with me. And she's just like incredible. And she was a lawyer from New York. And she was also a jewelry designer, where she sold and made all this really expensive jewelry. And nobody wanted to take the time to get to know who she was. And it was the summertime, and she'd hang out with me and my kids, and she'd hang out with the girls I sponsor, and we all rolled together. And she had other stuff other than alcoholism. And the voices in her head were getting really bad. And so she called me one day, and she said, Patty, I need to go to the hospital because I just can't take it no more. And So we dropped her off at the hospital. And meanwhile, the little 19-year-old that lived with me all these years, she would ask me all the time. She would say, why do you want to help these people? I don't understand. Nobody states that word. Everybody's mean to you, Patty. Why do you want to help these people? And at this time, the 19-year-old, we had the 4-bedroom house in the middle of the ghetto, and she was living with me. And so she got really close to this woman, too, you know. And so she called me up one day, and she said that they're shipping me off. She said they're shipping me off to a group home. And me and the little 19-year-old, who didn't understand why I didn't want to help anybody. She comes with me, and we go up to the psych ward. She said, would you please come and say goodbye to me? She said, it's because I love you so much. And you're my best friend. And so me and my little Tiffany shows up to the hospital to say goodbye to Morrissey. You know, and we went to the cutter house, and I got all her new clothes so she can go to her new home with all her new clothes. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me is you suit up and you show up. We don't get to pick who we help. God shows us who we get to help. And if I was going to judge her for the way she looked on the outside, I would have missed the biggest gift to my life. Because I got to meet the most incredible human being I've ever met in my life. And she absolutely, without a doubt, has changed and made my life a better place for today because I've met her. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has done is given me a whole brand new life. For that I can never repay. But I suit up and I show up every day. Because I don't want to miss what God is waiting for me. Thanks for letting me share.